The Arthropod.
In 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Welcome back, everybody, to Arthropod, your entomology podcast. I am one of your hosts for the day, Jonathan Larson of the University of Kentucky.
I'm your second host today, Michael Scarlett, Penn State Entomology. Larson, wow. It's been a while.
And that is important for us to point out. It has been a while since we have maybe been taking up residence in your headphones, and we took a bit of a hiatus here at Arthropod last semester. Mike needed to do some teaching. Jody was going up for her promotion, and so we wanted to take a little bit of a break, but we're back today, and we're very excited to be joined by Dr. Jess Hartshorn of Clemson University. You want to introduce yourself to the world, Jess?
Sure. Thanks for having me. I'm Jess Hartshorn. I'm an assistant professor of forest health at Clemson University, and my background is in entomology, which is how I know Michael and Jonathan. So thanks, guys, for having me on.
Yeah, thanks for agreeing to this. I guess full disclosure to our audience, Jess and I overlapped at the University of Arkansas when we were doing our degrees. So we were talking about before the show, that's been almost 5 years now since we left. It doesn't feel like that long, but it's
Mike,
getting there.
That means that you and I have known each other for a decade. How about that?
Right? Isn't that like, it feels weird to say that because I don't feel like
I know.
I'm glad you've landed on that happy thing because you both kind of gave yourself a sad earlier when you realized how long ago you had graduated. The look on both of your faces was very similar.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. Well, 5 years, that's half a decade. That's like when I put it in those terms, it just sounds like so much longer. It feels like I just defended yesterday.
Yeah, exactly. And part of the reason I asked Jess to come on here is when you were at University of Arkansas, you were in a forest entomology lab under Fred Stephen, who is well known in that sphere of entomology. And I've always liked forest entomology. Like I'm really interested in wood boring insects in particular, like bark beetles and longhorn beetles and jewel beetles, even though I didn't go into a forest entomology lab. So I was always interested in like what your lab and what you in particular were doing. And we chatted ESA about stuff, but I haven't really caught up on what you've been doing since you landed at Clemson. And for me, I was curious about what you're doing. And I thought it would be a great opportunity to let our audience hear that conversation. So I guess you were in a forest entomology lab at University of Arkansas. That's kind of what your degree was in. Are you still doing that? Are you working with forest insects or have you kind of changed course?
Yeah, so we do some work with forest insects in my lab. My title is an assistant professor of forest health. And so really anything that falls under that umbrella, we kind of touch on in my lab. So I have a student that's doing some bark beetle work in southeastern pines, you know, pretty standard traditional forest entomology, bark beetles and pine. And then I've got other students who are working with invasive plants. I've got a student who's doing the social side of things. So she's working with recreation users and the spread of invasive plants. And then I've also got a student working with a pathogen, working with laurel wilt. So the red bay ambrosia beetle and the Raffaella pathogen. So we kind of span the whole gamut of anything that falls under that forest health umbrella.
Oh, that's really neat that you got to expand beyond like what I guess what your roots are then. I didn't actually mean to make that pun.
I was kind of curious about the forest health terminology. Is that something that's relatively new or is this like an emerging identity within forestry? I know a professor here, Dr. Ellen Crocker, that's also the forest health specialist, extension specialist for our forestry department. And I didn't know if this was something that was kind of up and coming or how long that's been a thing in forestry.
Yeah, so that's a really good point because I think historically there have been kind of forest entomologists and forest pathologists and the meetings were set up that way. So, you know, it's a forest pathology meeting or a forest entomology meeting. And there's been a lot of talk, at least in the Southern Forest Insect Work Conference, which is a group that I'm a part of, and maybe even a name change, like opening it up to forest health and making it beyond only insect-driven experiments. And so there's definitely been some talk of that at least in the societies that I'm a part of. And I think there's definitely been an acknowledgement recently that forest entomology, forest pathology, and invasive plants and forest management, that these all kind of work together, and you don't have students coming out who are this classically trained in just one field or another. It has been shifting more towards that idea of holistic forest health rather than just one field and another.
I find that pretty fascinating, this de-siloing that we're seeing with some of this kind of stuff. And do you think it's driven by just a need for funding to integrate, to try and get people together to make these bigger, more powerful research groups? Or is it driven by, is this the best way to help forests?
I would like to think that it's driven by a little of both. There's definitely a push for integration among fields to get people to do those interdisciplinary works that are paradigm shifting and, you know, all the buzzwords that kind of go hand in hand with that. But I think there's a need there, but I think there's also just an acknowledgement that when you're going across the hall to talk to the forest pathologist all the time, maybe you guys should work together, and this might be a good way to address forest health concerns.
It reminds me of kind of what's going on in the push for One Health, where we're integrating entomology and healthcare workers and pathologists, like in human and animal health spheres, but just doing that in a forest setting instead of mm-hmm. human health.
And that's kind of the way that departments have been going. You know, we've seen a shift at universities from individual departments of pathology and entomology and plant sciences, et cetera, and kind of more of this like integrated model where you have a lot of different faculty doing different things under one roof. And I think that on one hand, it's kind of sad to see some of those classical and traditional aspects kind of die off. And then on the other hand, it's kind of nice to have that openness and that collaborative mindset.
I guess with that introduction in mind, do you want to tell us maybe a little bit about some of the research you're doing? This idea of this integrated kind of style, bringing forest pests and pathology together, like immediately I thought of things like bark beetles that are vectoring pathogens. Like that is a good place where mm-hmm. those two things intersect. And you mentioned that you're working on laurel wilt and the bark beetle that's transmitting it. So for a lot of the audience, they're probably not going to be familiar with any of what's going on with that. Even up here, I kind of sort of know there's a bark beetle vectoring a new pathogen that's killing a bunch of trees. So can you explain that a little bit and what you're doing with it?
Yeah, so it's really isolated to the southeastern United States at the moment, but there's a potential that this could become a much bigger problem just because the beetle and the pathogen seem to be able to use anything that falls under Lauraceae. And so initially it was thought, okay, it's the Red Bay ambrosia beetle. It can really only develop in Red Bay, which is a coastal species. Now that we've seen Red Bay pretty much get completely wiped out from most of the southeastern U.S., at least where laurel wilt is present, we're seeing it pop up in sassafras in South Carolina. It's been shown that it can develop in avocado, which is a Lauraceae species. And so that especially can be a problem because California has a massive avocado industry. And so if the beetle were to get transmitted with the pathogen over to California, we're not really sure what that would do economically as well as ecologically. So it's smaller than a grain of rice, but it's a pretty big deal in the southeastern U.S. At least it's isolated here at the moment, but where it's come through Red Bay is pretty much decimated.
We're very worried about it here in Kentucky. We've been talking a lot about it over the last year, and we're very concerned about our sassafras trees for sure. Mm-hmm. So keeping a close eye on it. I think it's been found in the state at least once or twice, but not quite as extensive as what you've dealt with.
Yeah, I think it's been found in Kentucky two times, if I'm correct. But some super cooling studies, they were super cool also, but super cooling studies have found that the beetle can survive up to minus 30, I think is what was reported. So That basically encompasses the entire range of sassafras and a lot of other Liriaceae species.
Don't tell me that. I don't want to get up here in Pennsylvania.
I know.
That's bad news.
Yep. So that's my student is looking at the development of the beetle and sassafras in South Carolina.
Okay. Are you doing like rearing studies or what's that project look like?
So she's cut down a lot of dead sassafras and some of them are being reared out in Colombia where laurel wilt is already present. She's also been doing some stuff in forests that have sassafras that has not yet been attacked by the beetle to look at inoculation studies of the pathogen. So how is the pathogen moving through the root system versus how is it moving above ground with the beetles? So she's got a couple different aspects of her project.
Okay. Oh, is it going to be similar to like elm yellows and some of these other pathogens where the sassafras roots kind of touch and fuse and then they can travel through the root systems?
So Red Bay does that. Red Bay will have root grafts, but with sassafras, they're mostly root suckers. And so they don't really graft as much as you think with like oaks and some other species, but they will shoot suckers up from their roots. And so you might have 50 seedlings around and only two mature trees that are providing the root system for the rest of those suckers. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So it's like a bigger clonal organism than what you would expect looking at the stems.
Right.
Oh, I didn't know sassafras did that. That's kind of cool.
Yeah. So that's what we're not really certain how the pathogen will move through the root system of sassafras because the root system is pretty different than what we see with Red Bay.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, that is common for forest pathogens like that to move through root suckers or move through root grafts into other stands. I see that a lot.
I know of some of the other research that you've been doing because I'm involved with it. I know you're doing some calorie pair work that I guess is also really invasive down in the Southeast. It was a little bit difficult for me to find stands of it up here. It's not quite as abundant as you made it out to be when we were talking about it. And I've got some sticks in my basement that I set out last year for borers to colonize, and I've collected leaf litter and extracted that and sent it down to you. So do you want to tell the audience like what's going on with those projects and what you're looking at with calorie pair?
Yeah, so calorie pear, most people probably know it as Bradford pear, the really showy white flowers that come out before any other tree is blooming in the really early spring. So for us, we can see Bradford pear, calorie pear flowers in late January, early February. In Florida, especially, like the further south you go, the earlier they come out. But we've got a lot of different stuff going on with calorie pear. So we're looking at the potential for allelopathy in the root system and seeing how native species grow in the presence of calorie pear and especially calorie pear litter fall. And so we're looking at that along an invasion gradient. We're also looking at pollinators. So what pollinators are coming to calorie pear? That's not really been looked at. Are these pollinators facilitating the spread by preferring calorie pear versus native plants? You know, what is this doing to urban forests, especially, and forests that line kind of suburban areas or agricultural areas where they were planted for ornamental? They're still planted in most of the United States. They're slowly being added to invasive species plant lists. Ohio now has a phase out. I believe South Carolina is now phasing them out. So that work is being done. We are seeing some changes to regulation as we're starting to recognize that they're impacting litter arthropods and pollinators and herbivores and all these other insect guilds. So we're looking at calorie pear from a lot of different angles, which is really cool. And yeah, you're helping us with the litter part of the experiment. Ellen Crocker at University of Kentucky is helping us with that as well. So yeah, hopefully we'll get some good data from a pretty big region and can really show what this thing is doing to our forested ecosystems.
I'm pretty fascinated by what's going to come out of that, just because it is such a popular tree. I mean, I know whole neighborhoods in this neck of the woods of Kentucky
that
in March you can drive through and it's just white. It is white petals everywhere, and people find it very pleasant and they're very proud of it in some cases till they fall apart and hit their cars and trucks and stuff. But I was wondering, how do you make your messaging around something like that? Like, how do you combat that kind of mindset where people, I work with a lot of ornamental plants, and it's hard for me sometimes to be like, you know, this one's, you probably don't want this one. And people are like, well, I just love it. I love it so much. How do you build a messaging program around that to try and convince people that there are other options out there, even for that ornamental value?
Yeah. So you have to meet people where they are in more than one way. And so physically, you have to physically put your message in places where people are going to see it. And so it's one of my students is working on human dimensions project with invasive plants. And part of that is looking at how do people purchase their plants? How do they make their purchasing decisions? And so getting your message to that effect is part of it. Also figuring out, you know, everybody has something that they really care about. And so for some people, that's pollinators, that's butterflies, it's honeybees, it's the bumblebees in their front yard. For some people, it's wildlife. For some people, it's birds. For some people, it's, you know, just general biodiversity. And so you have to find a way to attach meaning to that thing that this person cares about. And so a lot of times that's just one-on-one interaction and really picking out what is the holdup with this person in terms of getting them to select a different species. And then once you identify that, most people are pretty receptive. You know, you've got 5% that love you no matter what. You've got 5% that are never going to listen to you. And most people are in the middle. And so most people are receptive. Most people are going to talk to you. Most people are going to listen to your message as long as it's respectful. And I think that's another thing that we need to think about is actually listening to them and being respectful, no matter how much their opinion might differ from mine.
Absolutely. I agree. I love that you brought up that 5 and 5 thing. I often talk about it as the 20-60-20 rule, that 20% of people, they hate your guts. 20% of people love you. And you got to talk to that 60% and try and convince them of your argument. That's where extension really kind of makes its bread, is in that middle part. And I really am excited to see if you're going to publish some of that stuff, like in Journal of Extension in the future, about talking to people about how to meet their demands, because I feel like that's sort of the next step, which is odd for me, for extension to think about that we've been missing out on some of that, I think, in the past, of how do we connect this science to these people emotionally so that it actually resonates within them and they want to follow through with it. Because it's one thing to keep quoting, oh, you should plant, what is it, every fifth tree or something should be different. I can't remember the exact statistics that we use when we talk about tree diversity, but it's one thing to say that, and it's another thing to say, and this is why, like, think of all the bees, think of all the foxes and rabbits and birds. And I just, I'll be very excited to see what comes out of some of that and if it can defeat calorie pair.
Oh boy.
Yeah.
Well, so Dave Coyle, if you guys need another entomologist to talk to, he would be awesome on a podcast. So he's kind of my counterpart in the extension side of things. And he's doing a program called the Bradford Pear Bounty, where if you take a picture of yourself and your Bradford pear that you cut down from your backyard or front yard or wherever, or no, not wherever, from your own property, just cut them down from your own property. you can pick up a native tree to put in its place. And so I think people need that other option. You can't just say, like, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this. You have to give them, do this instead. You know, if you just tell people don't, the message kind of gets lost in the wash.
I also like that because it thinks about the customer, whereas I know I deal with a lot of nursery tree nursery owners, and you're like, oh, it's too bad that everything is red maple in Kentucky. Like, everybody wants to plant a red maple. What are they supposed to do? That's what people want to buy. They have to sell. So it's not their fault necessarily. So it's interesting to think about taking it to the customer to create that demand to see the changes in other industries. Mm-hmm. I've interrupted Mike twice. I'm gonna turn myself on mute and let him go.
Oh, he actually did mute himself, audience. And he's laughing at us as I say this out loud. No, I was just going to, I guess, wonder out loud how much of it too is like, we say don't plant Bradford pears, but we also need to provide an alternative. Like you said, do plant these trees, but like actually plant tree X, Y, and Z. Like, these are equivalent natives or equivalent ornamentals that won't spread and will fill that role of a pretty white early blooming tree that this is like the thing that you can put in place of calorie pear that we don't want you to plant. But I wonder how much of that too, we could, to get to John's point, go to nurseries and, you know, they, I've got, oh gosh, three or four nursery stock sale books, cause I'm putting some trees in my property and I'm shopping around this year. Like, just have it put in there. Like, hey, this is a great alternative to red maple. This is a great alternative to calorie pear. Like, nurseries in Kentucky saying everybody buys red maples, but if they put it in their, you know, little catalogs, like, hey, plant this instead, maybe they could increase some of those sales.
Yeah, you definitely need to have, I mean, there's multiple levels of stakeholders, you know, it goes all the way up to the policymakers and all the way down to the people that buy Bradford pear at Home Depot or wherever.
Yeah. I know here on campus, I was asked to be on the University Tree Commission. So we talk about all the tree plantings and tree removals. And we have to approve them, which is kind of cool. And every time a Bradford pear comes up, like, it's the running joke. Like, are we going to approve this one? It's a Bradford pear. Are we sure we want to take this one out? And there've been a couple of times where we've approved removals to like put a new building in. And there's like Bradford pears that are outside of the removal area, but we're like, oh, they're going to be in the area, just chop them down anyhow. So at least here, like, we are very pro get them out.
Good.
Which is, it's nice to see, at least on campus at Penn State.
See, you're affecting change from the inside.
Exactly.
That's what you should be doing.
I did want to go back just a little bit or stay on this topic for just a moment more. I didn't realize that Bradford pears have allelopathic leaves or can affect the soil around them and affect seedling generation. Is that a hypothesis that you're testing, or is it something that's been put out there and is widely known? What's going on with that? Because I'd never heard that before you said it just now.
Yeah, so it's suspected, definitely. Okay. And some of that suspicion is just because so many of the plants that we have that are successful invaders have allelopathic roots. And we see so many impacts from litter fall on insects and all other kinds of organisms. And so we just see that so frequently that it kind of makes sense that it would be there this time. But then also just in personal anecdotes and anecdotes of those in my lab, we've seen kind of dead spots surrounding Bradford pears and calorie pears that sort of suggest that there's something going on, whether it's in the leaf litter releasing something or if it's in the root system. So we're going to test that in a couple different ways.
Ah, cool. I'm interested in seeing how that goes. I'm most familiar with it because we have a lot of black walnuts in our area, and they're native that has like, right, does that, but I'd never really thought about it with other trees. So I'm really curious to see how that goes.
Yeah, us too. We just put up the greenhouse last week, and we are getting a bunch of seedlings this Friday, and we're planting them next week. So hopefully sometime this summer, this fall, we'll start to get some kind of an idea of what's going on and go from there.
How much does it hurt your heart to plant calorie pears, even if it's going into a greenhouse?
Well, I haven't done it yet, so I'll tell you on Tuesday.
Okay.
I'll tell you on Tuesday how it felt.
This is neither here nor there with that, but you guys might find it funny. We're bringing Tree of Heaven into greenhouses so we can rear them for spotted lanternfly food. And we had a mite outbreak, so I've got a paper coming out about mite control on Tree of Heaven.
Just let it go, man.
Right? It's like, actually, no, we want to keep these trees alive. Gotta feed our spotted lanternflies.
Gotta feed the other invasive species.
Uh-huh. Well, is there any other projects or anything you want to plug before? I know John had some things he wanted to ask you about, but is there any other research things you'd want to talk about and let the audience know about?
Oh, boy. Well, we talked about cattle repair. We talked about laurel wilt. The other big thing that we have going on is looking at bark beetles in southeastern pines in different drought conditions and relating that back to climate change and the use of prescribed fire to control those bark beetles. That's kind of the other bigger project that we have going on right now.
That is a very classic forest entomologist,
right?
Type of project.
Yeah, it's very traditional forest entomology, but in terms of climate change, because we've seen a kind of a range shift is what it looks like of southern pine beetle. And we don't really know what's going on with that. We don't really know what drought is going to do to our use of prescribed fire, because prescribed fire has been used to control and prevent outbreaks of southern pine beetle so much, but now these areas are experiencing such extreme drought. We just really don't know what is going to happen with population dynamics in those scenarios.
Is there, with the droughts, is there a chance like you can't even go in and burn because it's just too dry or too droughty to do the prescribed fires? Is that part of it?
Funny question. We actually didn't get to burn in the Clemson experimental forest last year, but not because it was too dry, because it was too wet. Because you only have a certain window that you can really burn, at least down here. That window is, most people burn in the winter, December, January, February. And it was just nonstop raining the entire time. We never got to burn. And then it was the growing season and then the burn bans come on. And so we basically went from one extreme to the other so quickly that we didn't even get to burn our sites last year.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That's not ideal.
Yeah. And then the other sites that we did get to burn, we actually had to put that on hold because of COVID. So.
COVID.
Yeah.
So, John, I know you had some questions about Jess's involvement, or I guess running of Feminist Forester. And I guess I could kick it off since I'm talking right now. Like, forest entomology, at least as far as I know, has been a really traditionally like male dominated aspect, even within entomology, which has been traditionally male dominated anyhow. So I guess, shifting gears away from research, could you talk a little bit about just how it is being a woman in such a male-dominated subfield of entomology? And
yeah, I mean, I think I've experienced the same stuff that every other woman in forest entomology has experienced in terms of other students not being super respectful and, you know, even up to being grabbed and, you know, things like that at meetings. And those stories, unfortunately, are not very rare in science in general. But, you know, the more subfield you go, forest entomology has been probably more historically male dominated compared to some other fields. And Molly Darr, who actually coincidentally is also at Clemson as a postdoc in my same department in forestry and environmental conservation. And so Molly and I have known each other for a long time. And several years ago, we organized a symposium at the Southern Forest Insect Work Conference. And we had four women in a row. We went from youngest to most senior, like graduate student, all the way up to the very first woman who was ever hired by Forest Health Protection, which is a division in the Forest Service. And so they all kind of shared their stories, and we got to hear how things had changed over the last 50 years or so in forest entomology, which was really cool. So we got a lot of interest. We then opened it up into a workshop at the North American Forest Insect Work Conference and got a lot of feedback there. We did some small group stuff and we did some individual interviews, and actually recently sent out a survey through the International Union of Forest Research Organizations as kind of like a climate study, if you want to think of it that way. And we got some really interesting information about, unfortunately, it ended up being kind of black and white between like men and women, and we weren't really able to go into even different ethnicities or LGBTQ plus identities or anything like that. So this was just very surface level initial digging into it. But we got about half and half male and female respondents, which was pretty good. And we had 184 respondents, I believe, which was awesome. And what we found was that the vast majority of women had only been in forest entomology for fewer than 15 years. Most were in that 5 to 10 year mark, whereas almost every single man that responded had been in forest entomology for 20 plus years. And so there was a stark shift in our survey results when there was a push to start hiring women. And you can see that in the respondents that we got. We got a lot of really horrible and really awesome stories at the same time from women and men through this survey. And we are hoping to publish that pretty soon, hopefully in the American Entomologist or similar, to get a pretty wide audience. Cause yeah, we were pretty interested in that. But all that to say, Molly and I created Feminist Forester kind of in response to that initial conference. And we've both posted on there. We've had other guest writers post on there. And then our Facebook and Twitter and stuff like that, we try to share other people's work as well. So that has sort of been parallel to the other work that we've been doing in on the social side of things.
I was kind of interested in seeing where it came from, just because it was something of a, I guess, a phenomenon once upon a time for me, where I knew you and then I followed Feminist Forester on Twitter. And then I was like, oh, wait, right. This is the same person. And it all kind of came together for me. And I realized, but as you've been going through this, I've read through some of the posts on there, and I'm curious about integrating those kinds of things into your science life, into your work life, where you're integrating this social aspect and talking to people about it. There was one post in particular that kind of spurred my inquiry on this on there, about how this is an extra level of work that's often required of people who are women, who are LGBTQ plus, or are people of color, where like you're creating a whole blog and you're creating whole symposia about this. What is that? How do you do that? Like, how do you push those two things together? And I mean, I guess we could even delve into the equality or fairness of that situation.
Yeah, so that's a really good point that I try to bring up whenever this sort of work is mentioned, is that in our push to hire more people of color, hire more women, hire, you know, like, increased diversity in our student population and our faculty population, that means that we start having requirements like there needs to be one person from an underrepresented group on every committee. And we start coming up with rules like that, which are good natured, because what they're trying to do is really put those voices at the table and have them heard. And unfortunately, when you're in this sort of transition zone, it also means that there's one or two people who are doing the vast majority of the service. And so, unfortunately, that just kind of has seemed to go hand in hand. So there are some ways of dealing with that. Like, instead of just nominating people of color for certain committees that are going to be mostly service and not really reflect on their promotion, or tenure and promotion if you're in academia, or, you know, nominate them for things that are going to actually reflect on that CV. And so when I get asked to do service that's not going to reflect positively on my CV, I don't always say yes. If I'm asked to do service that reflects positively on my CV and it's kind of a win-win, I'm definitely more likely to say yes to that. And I feel better asking other people to help me out if it's going to result in something that, you know, looks good to them and looks good on their department and looks good on their employer. So I don't think that it's always just one or the other. I think you can kind of marry those two ideas and not just put up the same underrepresented people over and over and over and over for the same stuff.
Yeah. I also like the idea of maybe getting people to acknowledge that service is important. I know everybody mm-hmm. here at UK in our department, and I think across the entire College of Ag, everybody gets an obligatory 5% service assigned to you as part of your assignment of effort. And it's always very, like, every time I've had a conversation with somebody about it, they just like hand wave it off and say, yeah, you'll have that covered because you're extension. It's like, well, no, this seems different than extension. It's got its own designation.
It's very different.
Yeah. So I hope that part of the conversation also comes around to saying, oh, well, if people take this seriously, if they recognize that service is helping the university, and if you put some effort behind it, it'll be valued when it is on people's CV.
Mm-hmm. And we are currently going through the process to redo our tenure and promotion processes, like our handbook. And so that conversation has come up several times when you get to the service section, because I'm 50% research, 50% teaching. And so service is sort of sprinkled in there, and it's not an official designation, at least in terms of my employment, but it is, like you said, still expected.
Yeah. It doesn't make money either, I guess, is the one way that a lot of people have put it to me. And it's like, I don't agree. I feel like if you do good service, you can increase people's interest in your department or in your university. And if you're opening the doors up, if we're doing what all of us are supposed to be doing as land grant practitioners, the three of us, like mm-hmm. we're supposed to be the school, like we're the one that's supposed to be like, hey, yeah, everybody can come here. I know it gets more complicated than that historically, obviously, but I don't know. I was very interested in reading through that and reading through your whole blog. And I was curious to hear more of your thoughts on it. Mike, did you have any questions about this part of it, or was I?
No, that's perfect. I'm just a white dude, so like,
but you're a white dude that uses your white dude influence to amplify the voices of other people who do not necessarily have that white dude influence. So
I appreciate that. I do the best I can.
Yeah. So it's all, you know, it's practice. It's not, none of us are perfect beings, and, you know, it's all just practice. You just got to meet it every day. Like I'm on a group that is organizing a symposium, or we submitted a symposium for ESA this year. And I really like that ESA says, you know, the makeup of your symposium matters. Like it matters if you ask people, if you ask the same people who get requests all the time, or if you kind of reach out and you get those early career professionals and you get people from different backgrounds and stuff. So we've done that with the North American Forest Insect Work Conference. We have in there, when you submit symposia and you have your potential list of speakers, it needs to be diverse. It cannot just be your buddies from down the hall that you've worked with for the last 15 years, except that's kind of us though, I guess. Just buddies that have known each other for a long time.
This is a podcast that me and John run and Jody run. We get to choose who we want. We try to make it diverse, but it's real easy to ask our friends to come on. part of it is honestly, like, you're a lot more likely to say yes than if we just cold email somebody. Yeah. Somebody that doesn't know us.
Yeah, for sure. I get it.
But that's definitely been part of the mission for Arthropod. I know when I started it a long time ago, was I think that if you look at our guest list, it's heavily, it's very young and it's very female. It's very different than maybe what it looks like on the other side of the equation after grad school, because we do have a lot of students that have been on the show and everything, but it's something that I think is good to attempt to try and keep people interested in keeping going in entomology and in the field, just to say like, oh no, there are people that are being successful that resemble me. So.
Oh yeah, for sure. Absolutely. That representation goes a long way.
I guess while we're on the topic, I was surprised by your survey results that such a large proportion of younger forest entomologists and forest professionals are female. Yeah. I feel like that's more reflective of what's happening in entomology writ large too. I know here like 70% of our grad student body are women.
That's pretty standard for STEM now, I think, is that the undergrad population, women outnumber men, but then the further you go and then you hit postdoc and it's still fairly high. And then after postdoc, it really drops off. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's nice to see that at least it's not staying male dominated.
Yeah.
Now. So that's cool.
Yeah. I came out of that survey, like there were a lot of really awful things in there just because this is a survey about like your time in a field that maybe you weren't treated very nicely. And so there was a lot of like negativity in it, but I really came out of it like feeling kind of proud about forest entomology and the people that I know and I work with, because even though I've experienced some pretty awful things myself in forest entomology, by and large, people are just awesome and supportive. And I feel really lucky that I've fallen into the niche that I have, because I was not, like, if you would have told me 20 years ago that I was going to be a forest entomologist, I would have been like, what is that? I don't even know what that is. And so to be here now is just, I feel very lucky.
That reminds me of a question that we didn't ask at the top that I usually like to. So maybe we'll wrap up with this. How did you become an entomologist and a forest health professional? Like, were you always interested in that? Or, I mean, I guess if 20 years ago you didn't know you would be a forest health person, then no.
Let's see. What was I doing 20 years ago? I was interested in like radio and broadcast management and journalism. And that's what I had applied to go to Ohio University.
That's and very was different.
Accepted there. And I was going to go like be a journalist and like be a broadcaster. I did that in high school and really liked it. Then I kind of shifted towards English education and literature my first year in, and ended up staying in Dayton to go to community college rather than go off to OU because it was a lot more expensive. And so while I was there, I took a class like environmental science or something really broad like that. And that kind of re-sparked my interest in science because it had kind of been beaten out of me in school. And I thought, you know, when I was a little kid, I wanted to be a veterinarian. Like, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to be a vet. And so I went to Southern Illinois because they had a really good zoology program and it was just far away from home enough to like try to adult, but not be like on the other side of the country, you know?
Plus a cool mascot.
Yeah. Plus it's a Saluki, which is super awesome. And while I was there, I met Jay McPherson, which if you're listening to this and you are an entomology person, you probably know Jay because he is the guy that walks around ESA with a little tag on his name tag that says troublemaker, and he's the only one that has it. And he was my undergraduate advisor, and I told him I wanted to be a veterinarian, and he said, no, you're going to be an entomologist. And I was like, no, doc, I don't even know what that is, but I'm certainly not going to be somebody who plays with bugs because bugs are gross and I'm not going to do that. And I had to take his invertebrate zoology course as a pre-vet, and that was the class that kind of flipped my switch, I guess, for entomology. So then I got a research assistantship with Matt Wiles, who is an aquatic entomologist, or an aquatic ecologist, really, at SIU. And so I worked in his lab for a year. Ended up also working in the Department of Forestry at SIU, and was kind of like, I can work in forests and play with bugs. What? This is super awesome. And turns out when you Google forest entomology graduate program or whatever it was that I Googled, the first person that popped up was Fred Steven. And so I just emailed him and I said, hey, I'm looking at grad school. Do you have anything going on? Your lab looks really interesting. And that was 11 years ago. So
I can't believe that you just Googled forest entomology. that's really funny to me. I love it.
You know, one of the benefits of being a first generation college student is that I don't know any better. And so I learned way late that it's like, what are you talking about? You just cold called a professor that you didn't know, and you didn't even know who he was or anything. And I'm like, yeah, how else do I do it? You know, there was nobody to tell me that that's not how you did things. So that's just kind of how I did it.
Hey, it worked out.
Yeah, it did. It did. Fred is one of my favorite people, and I'm so glad that I got to spend 6 years in his lab. So
cool.
Yeah, it's worked out.
Well, I think that is a really good place to wrap it up. Thank you for agreeing to come on to the podcast and talk to us for a while and tell us about your research and how you got into entomology and everything that we talked about. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. I enjoyed it.
Good luck defeating the calorie pair.
Yeah. That'll be my students. That's what you have students for.
Oh, yeah.
If people kind of wanted to check out what's going on in your lab or find out more about Feminist Forest, or are there some resources you could point them to online that we can share today?
Yeah. Our forest health is just cuforesthealth.weebly.com. And then Feminist Forester is now hosted through WordPress. And so that one is feministforester.wordpress.com. So,
and if people want to find you on
Google us.
Yeah, you could just Google it, right?
Yeah.
If people wanted to find you on Twitter, is it just at Feminist Forester?
I think it's at Fem Forester.
Oh, character counts and everything.
Yeah.
Well, I just wanted to echo what Mike said. Thanks for being on the show. We really appreciate it. It was a lot of fun learning about your program. And if you want to find the show on the web, you can find us at arthro-pod.blogspot.com. You can find us on Twitter, arthro_podshow. If you want to find me, I'm at Bugman John.
And I am at mscavarla36 on the bad website.
On the bad website. And we are back now. We're going to be producing more content this year. We're committing ourselves to being proactive and hopefully getting 2 episodes out a month. So look forward to another episode of Arthropod here very soon.
It's time for our insect heroes to put away their nets and pheromone traps. Join us next time, same bug time, same bug channel, as the Arthropod gang make the world safe from poor insect podcasts. Until then,
keep on bugging.